everybody. Welcome to KLCC's Northwest Passage podcast. I'm Rachel McDonald, KLCC News Director.
I'm Ani Katz, host of Morning Edition.
I'm Brian Bull, news reporter in Eugene.
And I'm news reporter Chris Lehman.
So it's been another busy week of news here in Western Oregon and around the world. We'll check in with Brian and Chris about stories they've been working on and taking a look at this week. But first, Ani, what are some of the top stories from the KLCC newsroom?
So we had several housing-related stories this week. The Eugene City Council voted to distribute nearly $2 million towards tackling homelessness in Lane County. This moves the city closer to establishing a low-barrier public shelter, which has been discussed, obviously, for a while. Specifically, councilors voted to allocate almost $1 million to build a tent-like structure. There are concerns about this. Councilor Emily Semple remains concerned about the lack of specifics, just in general, with the project.
We got all these plans, but it might be, 2 years till we get a location? I'm really frustrated by putting all this money out in front of any possibility of it really happening. I'm still in favor of this, but not having a site first, it's making me kind of dubious.
Semple did approve the motion, but Councilors Betty Taylor and Mike Clark both voted no. In other housing-related news, one of our reporters, Amy Brenneman, attended this week's groundbreaking of an affordable housing complex that'll be constructed at 6th and Oak in downtown Eugene. And more downtown news, city staff along with a design firm are working on a town square design for the park blocks here in Eugene. This is hopefully going to create a permanent location for the Lane County Farmers Market and then move work along with the Eugene City Hall as well. So these stories, which are kind of all related, are on our website. KLCC.org.
And with that town square project, it's interesting because Eugene has been without a city hall for several years now. They were going to rebuild it on the site that previously held the city hall. Now that site is planned for a new Lane County courthouse. And they did a land exchange. The city and county did a land exchange. So what's now called the Butterfly Lot, which is a parking lot across from the existing county courthouse, is the site that they're planning to put a city hall on. Now, when I spoke with Will Dowdy with the city, he seemed to think that, you know, besides this planning process that's underway, there aren't really any barriers to this project taking place. But knowing the city of Eugene and the way things work here, I'm a little bit dubious, to quote Emily Semple,
right,
that this is, you know, I'm not sure what this is going to look like or how long it's going to take.
Well, and also, every single time I drive by the Butterfly Lot, it's now full of cars. So they've given us this parking, and then they're going to take it away, which will be in of itself another issue, because clearly we don't have enough places to park downtown.
And meanwhile, there's a courthouse levy that just was recently defeated, and so the funding and future of that project is pretty much up in the air.
Exactly. So moving to animal news, there were several cougar sightings earlier this week in Lane County. Joe Stack, a wildlife biologist with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, is urging people to use caution, especially during their more active hours of dusk and dawn. So if you've got that great idea to go and head out and see the sunrise or set on a hiking trail in Eugene, be careful.
You know, obviously we live in cougar country. You know, there are cougars. And you can expect to, you know, that there could be cougars really any most places you go in Lane County.
Our next door neighbor a couple years ago saw a cougar wandering around the bus stop where her child and mine catch the bus up in the Spencer Butte area. And yeah, she spent the next 5 months of the remaining year personally driving her daughter to that bus stop ever since.
That seems fair.
It's a little alarming.
We've been having all kinds of deer problems in our garden this year. So I'm just wondering if these two issues can kind of like, meet in the middle somehow, and the cougars can take care of the deer maybe, and then they'll be fed and they won't be hanging out at bus stops or something. I don't know. Just an idea.
You have to talk to the cougar community, I think.
There was an article in the Newport News Times about a cougar sighted in Newport area, and in fact it was seen killing a deer. So they're trying.
They found them. They like venison too.
So, Chris, you're up in Salem, and I know the legislature is no longer in session, but a lot of things are kind of wrapping up there. Can you tell us what you've been watching this week?
Sure. Well, I've been keeping an eye on the governor signing bills. This is bill signing season, and she signed a bunch this week, but still a few weeks left to make up her mind on the rest, but not aware of any potential vetoes at this point. But the news regarding the governor this week that caught a little bit more attention was that the Oregon Republican Party announced an effort getting underway to recall the governor. So what does that mean? Well, they'll have a few months to collect a ton of signatures from people who want to recall the governor, and they need at least 280,000, and realistically, they need more than that because every time you collect signatures, some turn out to be not valid. So they have a relatively short period of time to collect all of those signatures, and if they successfully get those signatures, then it still has to go before voters for a statewide vote. So the road to actually recalling the governor is a long one, and it seems unlikely. There's two big barriers that they have to cross there, the signature gathering and then the statewide vote. And keeping in mind that the governor won re-election less than a year ago on a statewide vote, so it's not clear why enough people would have changed their mind in less than a year to vote on getting rid of the governor. That being said, it's certainly one of those political dramas that captures attention. One might argue that's the whole point of this scenario by the Republican Party, is to get people talking about their efforts, regardless of whether or not they are successful. So that's one thing we've been watching.
Just can you explain what the reasoning is behind this recall effort?
Well, it is true that they do have to state sort of some reasoning when they're circulating these recall petitions. So they run through a list of bills in the legislature that the governor supported that the Republican Party doesn't like. You have to wonder, though. There's always going to be some dislike from one party to the other as far as what issues they support. So, saying that the governor supports bills that the Republican Party doesn't like is sort of a normal part of the political process. It's not an accusation of corruption or something like that. No, they do go a little bit further and sort of question her loyalties and so forth. And you can look up their arguments, and I don't think we have time to go through them all. Certainly, if they are successful in getting all those signatures, we'll be hearing a lot more about it during the brief campaign that would follow. I think it all boils down to they just don't like the governor. I really don't think there's a whole lot more to it than that at this point. So the other political story, which is somewhat related to the governor in that she signed a bill, this bill is called the Student Success Act. You probably heard about it earlier in the legislative session around May, and it would create a business tax that would fund K through 12 education. A Democrat said it was a pretty big deal, kind of a once in a generation game changer for public schools in Oregon. Well, some in the business community did support that bill. Others say that it's going to create hardships for them, as well as for Oregonians who would pay those taxes in the form of increased prices being passed down to consumers. So there was a group of businesses that were gathering signatures to force a statewide vote on the tax portion of the bill. And they announced this week that they were abandoning that effort. So Democrats cheered that and said that, it was a relief because they wouldn't have to worry about waging a statewide campaign to defend this tax. The group that decided to drop out of that effort said that, Democrats in the legislature had played some games in terms of moving the potential election date up. It would have been a special election in January. Those are tougher to get people's attention focused around coming right out of the holidays. And they also said that, it just seemed like there wasn't enough, momentum for it at this time. So it's always a challenging thing to get signatures and to get something on the ballot right out of a legislative session. It has been done in the past, but this week's news was a fairly significant development in terms of that tax on businesses.
Well, Chris, thank you so much. We also have Brian Bull here in the studio. And Brian, you accomplished something that you've been working on for a couple of years this week.
Yeah, it's not that I'm very slow at things. It's just that I try to be very thorough. This week saw the culmination of more than a year and a half's worth of audio and video gathering. For disclosure's sake, my three children are all in the 4J School District's Natives program. And when they announced a couple years ago that they're going to be doing their first ever totem pole project from tree to totem, I figured it'd be fun and interesting to follow this log's journey. So my footage goes back to the fall of 2017 with some ambient sound of a western red cedar being felled in Deadwood, then taken to a mill to be processed and grooved in Veneta, and then to the Natives building in Eugene. And there I talked to Vic Hansen, who's master carver for the project. And as a group of Native students began chipping away at the heavy bark with chisels, he kind of explained what the first steps are going to be.
The first step is to take the bark off. The step after that is to smooth the wood so that it's ready to draw the animals on. And then after that, you start carving the animals.
I do want to point out that half a year earlier when he talked to me, this was the late spring of 2017, the Oregon Country Fair Board had voted to kill plans to erect a so-called story pole that had been worked on for several years by non-Indians. This pole, the story pole, heavily used artistic elements, very similar to Haida-style carving, but did not incorporate any indigenous carvers. I think it was just freestyle. Used a lot of non-traditional aspects to it, like non-native animals. So critics, including some Native Americans who saw the story pole as an act of cultural appropriation, blasted the idea in the final months, and last I heard, that story pole is still sitting somewhere in a Eugene warehouse. This pole project, though, utilized about 100 carvers, representing dozens of different tribes from Chippewa to Coos to Nez Perce, and was done under the auspices of Natives administrators. So it's ducked the controversy that the Oregon Country Fair faced. So Tuesday, the totem pole went up with about 60 people gathered to hear remarks and drumming following its installation. Current and former Native students were in attendance. Now Sheldon High School has a prominent carving out front that displays animal symbols that were chosen by members of that school's Native Youth Club. I asked Natives Director Brenda Brainerd if the pole looks any different set up as opposed to being in the shop for 2 years.
It looks immensely different. It looks bigger. When it was laying down, it didn't look so huge, but now that it's up, it looks massive to me. I think each clan animal seems bigger.
Now, there is one more totem pole to be finished from that same tree that was felled back in 2017, and that's being painted currently and is soon to be installed at North Eugene High School sometime in the very near future.
It's pretty extraordinary to see the photos and video that you took, the transformation from this basically just a log to this amazing art piece.
Right. It's incredible, the transformation. And so this was a kind of a fun project for me to do because I often report on things after a lot of developments have already occurred. And this is one I got to see from start to finish.
So my mom is obviously regular listener of the show. I don't hear from her that often while I'm hosting. And she texted me as soon as your feature aired because she thought it was so awesome. So very, very high comments from my mom.
Oh, cool.
And me. It was very interesting.
Cool.
You are listening to the Northwest Passage on KLCC. I'm Rachel McDonald with Ani Katz, Brian Bull, and Chris Lehman. And now it's time for us to talk about something from the news that's sticking with us this week. And Brian, let's start with you.
So my big national story of the week, well, let's just admit it. Movies like Blade Runner and Back to the Future lie to us. We don't have flying cars. We don't have android people yet. We don't have any gas-pumping robots as of yet. But here's something. Pizza giant Domino's is beginning to use self-driving cars for its delivery service. They're pairing up with a company called Nuro, which has a vehicle called the R2 of all things. And it's being phased in currently on a pilot basis for customers in Houston, Texas. So what people can do is when they call in their order through an app or through, I suppose, traditional phone, they can track the progress of their order on a Domino's app. And then when the vehicle arrives, they punch in a personal identification number or code that opens up a compartment and they can retrieve their pizza. Domino's says it's doing this because human labor is getting too expensive. I was personally hoping myself that the car would have something like a cannon or something that would shoot the pizza at your doorstep, but I guess they're trying to be a little more careful than that. In this article, though, by Business Insider, they are also reducing their vehicle use for bicycles. So, you know, until they invent the self-pedaling bike, I guess, human delivery people can still partake of the experience and stand a chance of getting confronted at the doorstep with, "Where's my crazy bread? I ordered crazy bread." Go figure. I was hoping for drones, too, but
that'd be awesome.
Too many pizzas on the roof, I suppose.
I don't drop it down your chimney or something.
Oh. Chris, what's on your mind this week?
Well, earlier we were talking about animals, cougars and deer. I heard something this week about a smaller animal, the friendly neighborhood scorpion. Specifically, the fire department in Kaiser this week reported that a woman had dropped off a box of 4 live scorpions that she had found near a playground at a local park in Kaiser. And these scorpions, the fire department kind of took an affection to them and gave them names. Their names are Timmy, Lynn, Ted, and Jeremiah. I'm not sure who gets the honor of having a scorpion named after them. But these apparently, I did not know this, but there are scorpions. We kind of think of them as a desert kind of creature maybe, but these are Pacific Northwest forest scorpions. They are native to the area and are found throughout the Willamette Valley, but they are nocturnal and therefore we don't see them very often. They live under rocks or logs and prefer moister situations. So you know, they're nice scorpions. They also apparently, according to the research by the firefighters, they can sting and they do sting their prey when hunting, but they would rather play dead than trying to sting people when they are disturbed. So you know, unless you directly step on one or something like that, they're probably just going, you know, they are more afraid of you than you are of them. I know that's hard to believe when it comes to scorpions. So thank you to the woman who rescued the 4 scorpions from the playground, and thank you to the brave firefighters who figured out that these things aren't too much of a threat, but you know, they're going to hang around the fire department and be an educational outreach item for the time being.
Do we know how big these scorpions are?
Well, the Kaiser Fire District posted photos of them on their Facebook page, so there's not a lot of context. You know, they're not like sitting next to a dollar bill or something. So I think they're small creatures, but nevertheless, they are scorpions.
I will never hike in the Willamette Valley again. Thank you, Chris.
Just don't set up your tent, you know, in scorpion territory.
When I lived in the desert in the Middle East many, many years ago, we got really good at, you had to check your shoes before you put them on if you left them outside or actually even inside. So now I guess when I go camping in the Northwest, I will now be checking my shoes again. Wish I had known that 10 years ago.
That was a good policy.
I think it's really necessary now.
Wasn't it about a year ago we did a story about high jumping worms kind of appearing in little random clusters across Oregon?
Oh, really?
The video's crazy, but now we've got that. Now we've got scorpions on top of that. I'm not sleeping anymore.
I was listening to a Morning Edition this week, and we had a story from Tom Bonsey on trail restoration on the Pacific Coast Trail and the East-West Pacific Northwest Trail, which I didn't even know about that particular trail. And they're trying to make the hikes safer, especially where they sometimes require people to walk along busy highways like 101 on the Oregon coast.
Mike Scott, who's now the mayor of Manzanita, used to regularly hike a section north of his town.
You come off the south end of Neocone Mountain and you find yourself for a couple of miles on 101 coming down the hill to Manzanita, and it is not much fun. I mean, the big trucks going by and so forth, it's not very safe.
So I just thought that was a neat story that, especially for the summer as people are getting outside. And also, you know, people do these long hikes like the Pacific Crest Trail that we know a lot about. And to make them safer for bikers seems like a good idea. Plus, they're using labor from the Northwest Youth Corps, which is great for kids getting outdoor work and experience. So thought that was a cool story. And also, our reporter Amy Brenneman reported on the new webcams at the Oregon Coast Aquarium, which have become my favorite time waster at work.
We have accomplished nothing this
week. Yeah, exactly. Because you can check on the avian exhibit, the shark tanks, and Ani and my favorites, the otters, which are super, super cute and fun to watch.
They were wrestling so much at like 8 a.m. yesterday morning. So if I sounded distracted during my newscast, it's because there were otters wrestling in the background.
So you're watching the otters while you're on
I
the air.
I may have it on the screen sometimes. If it's that or the weather temperatures. So, you know, it's I gotta alternate. You
what
know?
A
give
toss
us
up.
Updates.
I can give you updates. They're now eating. They're now – there's one that seemed to be irritated with the other two. They all have names, of course, but it's hard to tell from further away. But it is if you're looking for something to do during the day, I'm telling you, this otter cam, it's like totally worth it.
That fire station needs the scorpion cam now.
No, they don't, actually. So speaking of otters, does anybody know what Hermione Granger's Patronus is in Harry Potter?
It's an otter.
It's an otter.
Wow.
Well, I got to speak to a band that started a new genre of music, which I didn't even know existed until actually a few days ago. Wizard rock is a subgenre heavily influenced kind of by indie punk rock. It was created by two brothers from Massachusetts, Paul and Joe DeGeorge. And they are the group Harry and the Potters. And essentially, Wizard Rock is all about the Harry Potter books. And there's many, many groups that now perform this kind of music. They have a huge following because obviously the Harry Potter fan base is very large. And I would put myself very firmly in that fan base. So they're performing in Eugene on Sunday. And I got to speak with the brothers while they were on tour. They're currently like kind of in Washington and BC. And we talked a little bit about their music and totally got to, you know, geek out about the Harry Potter books. I think it'll be a great show. All ages. It's not just for kids. So that was kind of a fun interview that I got to do and get myself excited to keep reading the books with my kids.
And they do songs and music inspired by Harry Potter,
they I presume. They perform as, both of them perform as Harry Potter in different stages of his life. And cool. All their albums, now every group is different in this genre, but all of Harry and the Potter's albums are about the books. And so this latest album that they're touring for, they wrote it about Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows. And so it's actually kind of a political album because for those that have read it, it's kind of a dark book. So it's actually kind of a great time to be touring and playing this kind of music about politics and media and dictators, et cetera, et cetera. So
there's some anti-Voldemort bias probably inherent in the
lyrics. I think so. I think that's true. Yes.
All right.
Thanks for joining us for this week's edition of the Northwest Passage podcast. I'm KLCC News Director Rachel McDonald.
I'm the host of Morning Edition, Ani Katz.
I'm reporter Brian Bull.
And I'm reporter Chris Lehman.
Thanks, everyone.
I saved you from a basilisk. I think that deserves a kiss. But you're all over to Thomas. I got a feeling in my gut. It was like my insides were